As I said, I'm John Cornelius, alcoholic. I also point out that I'm a recovered alcoholic. That causes upset every now and then. But our big book says that we have recovered and have been given the ability to help others recover. And I'm not going to argue with the big book. If it says we're recovered, we're recovered. First time that came up, my first sponsor always introduced himself as a recovered alcoholic. And everybody else would tap dance around and say they were recovering. And I asked him about it one time, and he said, well, he thought he was Mark Twain. Everything had to be one of those Aesopian fables with him. He said, when you were in the Marine Corps, you got shot, didn't you? And I said, yeah. He says, what happened? I said, some guy shot me. He says, no, what happened? And I said, well, a guy shot me, and corpsman came and took me back to the first aid area and patched me up, took the bullet out and wrapped it up and sent me back. He said, did you recover from your bullet wound? I said, yeah. And he says, good. Are you bulletproof? Well, no. And he says, well, you recovered from your alcoholism, you're just not alcohol proof. And so far, that's been true. I've recovered, and I've tried to avoid ever finding out whether I was alcohol proof. Let me get some of the history out of the way here. I was born 3 years after AA started, and if you're mathematically inclined and not challenged with an advanced degree in philosophy, you can figure that out. I'm 64 years old because AA will be 67 years old this Monday, day after tomorrow. I let AA have a 3-year head start so they'd be ready for me when I got here. I was born and raised in a small town in northwestern Pennsylvania in the mountains, coal mining area, farming, a couple little steel mills and stuff like that. Grew up at the end of the Depression era, and my parents were keenly aware of the Depression. They both lived through it, and it was a constant reminder to me that I should be very, very careful of my shoes, my clothes, my food, the house, anything that I handled. I had to be careful because it costs money, you know. That's my main memory from childhood was, be careful of that, it costs money. And I was a hillbilly, I must have been, because my brother and I walked to school, and we had to cross the creek, we called it then, it's creek, I guess now. I got a little bit of sophistication. But we crossed the creek to get to school, and we carried our shoes and our socks until we got to the edge of town, and then we sat down and put our shoes and socks on to go to school because Dad didn't want us wearing out shoe leather on the way to school. He wanted us to wear shoes while we were there but not wear them out. And that was sort of the way we were, and the Second World War, I lived through that, and it was hardship time because everybody had a lot of money because the economy was fantastic, and but there was just nothing to buy with the money. You just didn't have much to do. I lived in a small town, grew up in that small town, was ill. I was very ill as a child, which was very difficult because I was ill during the time of the Second World War. I spent a lot of that time in hospitals. The first hospital I went to was a polio hospital. I had polio meningitis as a child. And one day they examined me in the polio hospital, and the next thing I knew, I was sitting out on the loading dock next to the garbage cans in my bed, and the bedside stand and everything I'd touched, because they found out that I had TB. And so immediately I was shipped off to a TB hospital where everybody was an adult. And here I am, this 4, 5, 6-year-old kid. And they would remember they had a kid in the ward for about 15 minutes. And then it was business as usual. So I didn't have much of an innocent childhood. I grew up fairly quick and fairly aware of what was going on. And plus, I was extremely shy and bashful. I just wouldn't talk to adults. I wouldn't talk with my own friends if there were more than three of them. I just shut up. I never spoke out loud. Come time to go to school, they'd ask me what my name was, and I'd just stand there. And later on, they'd ask me to answer a question. I'd know the answer. I'm not dumb, but I couldn't get the answer out. God was still alive then, and we read the Bible before school every morning, and would come my time to read the Bible, and I'd just stand there, couldn't do it, shaking that Bible. And I had one or two teachers that meant well, and they tried to force me to talk. And one of two things would happen. I would either throw up or pee my pants, or sometimes both. And I didn't live near the school, so they couldn't send me home. Became sort of a messy thing to do. So the word went out, don't ask him to do anything. It's a mess to clean it up, and it smells badly for the rest of the day. So I made it through the rest of school, grade school, high school. Never once did I speak aloud in public. I just didn't do it. They gave me a part in a senior class play, and all I had to do was walk across the stage and say two things, and I couldn't say that, so somebody behind the curtain would yell my line for me. You know, that was the extent of my participation. And of course, when you don't talk, I had become aware early on that there was a vast difference between boys and girls. And I wanted to do something about that, but I was afraid to do something about it, so nothing got done. And I was a good swimmer. One of the women that was my therapist in the polio hospital had taught me how to swim when I was 3.5, 4 years old. And I was a natural swimmer. And by the time I was 11 years old, I was I was the fourth fastest freestyle swimmer in the United States. They were looking at me for the 1956 Olympics because I was that good. And I was given 11 different scholarships to different universities. And I was afraid to do anything about it. My parents forced me to go to one university. They had offered a complete scholarship and room and board and a little job to give me some money and everything like that. My parents were all for that. It would mean they didn't have to spend anything. And they put me on a bus one day, and I went to visit this university. And I got there, went into the bus station, asked the guy behind the counter, stammered out to him, what time's the next bus go back? And he told me, and that meant I had to wait about 3.5 hours. So I sat down and waited in the bus station, ate something at the bus station. I don't know if you've ever eaten at a bus station, but it's not haute cuisine by any stretch of the imagination. And I went into the bathroom. The bathroom was dirty, and some pervert made overtures towards me. And I caught the bus and went home, and my mom and dad were all excited about their son that's going to go to the big university, and they asked me what I thought about it, and I said, well, it was dirty, crowded, food was terrible, and when I went to the bathroom, some guy followed me in and did things. And they told me I didn't have to go there. I wasn't going to go anyhow, but they agreed that I shouldn't go there, so I didn't go. And I quite honestly, I was ready to just do what everybody else around me did. And that was either go into the steel mill or go into the mines or stay on the farm. It didn't make any difference to me. I wanted to do the place where I could get by with the least amount of interaction with other people the place where I could go and no one would bother me. Coal mines looked good. I spent one day in the coal mine and strip mine and began to look real good because I don't do well a mile under the ground laying on my side digging coal. So I was out of that. That didn't work. Then, unbeknownst to me, my high school guidance counselor and one of my teachers and my parents got together and they enrolled me in the local college. Let me explain this. This small town I was in, they used to bill themselves as, this is a small town with a small Christian college in it. And here I am going to this small Christian college in this small town. We had a train that went through too. I always wanted to get on it and go somewhere. But I went to the school, I was on the swimming team, I did well. I was on an unbeaten swimming team for 2 years. I fell in with a bunch of what we refer to in AA as lower companions, and I had a wonderful time with them. I had my first drinking experience. Oh, incidentally, when I was 11 years old, my first swimming coach believed in better winning through chemistry, and he had started me on Benzedrine when I was 11. That was in 1949 I started doing drugs. And then a couple years later, he and another coach decided that I wasn't big enough, and they started me on anabolic steroids. And then I found alcohol myself one night at a fraternity party, got drunk. I had 17 years of not talking to make up for. I just started talking. And somebody said I had a speech impediment. I would stop to breathe every now and then. And just, I just started talking, and I had 17 years of anecdotes and jokes to tell before I got started. And I loved it. And there was a woman there. She was an upper class girl, and I think she was trying to get a letter for making the team. Think about that a minute. And it became my turn to go for a walk in the woods with her. And I went, and I lost my virginity. And I had been trying to give it away for a long time, and no one had taken it. And I'm just quite honestly, I was getting real tired of handling it all by myself, too. And I'm not dumb. Not dumb. I knew the logic here. Drink, sex. Drink, sex. I tried to make sure that I was always in one of the other modes. And it just was so much easier when you were drinking or drugging. See, this was the late 50s, before the drug scene really came. And I was one of the few that was doing drugs. And I was doing this speed And then one day I overtrained. I used to train in a bar before swim meets. And instead of going to this training table and eating good food for, swimming, I ate bar food, blind robins, hard-cooked eggs pickled in beet juice and vinegar and chili and beef jerky, things like that, hard-cooked. Eyeballs of newts or whatever. And one time I just sort of overtrained, had a little bit too much to drink and too much to eat, and I swam the 1500 meter race, which is the metric mile. I got sick about the 8th lap of a 73 lap race, and I was sick 7, 15, 18, 20, 21, 22, and all this. I don't chew a lot, so all this stuff that's floating in the pool is recognizable. I only have to swim through it once, and I get it splashed into the other lanes. And I won the meet. they complained about it, but I won. And my swimming coach and I had a long talk afterwards. They said, "Why are you drinking before swim meets?" He says, "I don't mind if you drink after. It's the fact I drink with you. You know that." And he was right. And I said, well, I'm too nervous to get out there. He says, no problem. They got this great thing called meprobamate. First tranquilizer. Woo! And all I had to do was take three or four of those in the morning, and I would be okay. And then just before the meet, take three or four Benzedrine, and I would be wired and ready to go. And it was just wonderful. But remember, this is a small Christian college in a small Christian college town. And my drinking and several of my friends' drinking progressed to the place where they realized they were dealing with some small Christians. And they sent me on my way. They suggested that I go into the Marine Corps and get myself straightened out, or the military. I chose the Marine Corps to get straightened out, not one of my greatest choices. Sometimes I got so straight in the Marine Corps I couldn't move. It's okay. Listen, if this guy doesn't like kids, we're in trouble. So I went in the Marine Corps. I was on the Marine Corps swimming team. I was a lifeguard swimming instructor. I thought, this Marine Corps stuff isn't really that bad. And then one day they said, you're going to go aboard ship and be the lifeguard swimming instructor. And I said, well, okay. But take your gun with you. They like to call it rifle, but it was my gun, you know. And I got to some place called Beirut, Lebanon in 1958. And they said, we'd like to have you be the lifeguard swimming instructor on this, but there's people shooting at us in there, so take your gun with you. And this was not my idea of what I should be doing, but the first night in Beirut, Lebanon, I'm in a foxhole at the end of the runway of the international airport, and there's bullets going over our heads. You can see the tracers going by every now and then. And I was scared to death. I don't know about the rest of the Marines, but this Marine was, I was afraid. And I noticed that the guy that was in the foxhole with me, he was not afraid. And I said, Punch, aren't you afraid? And he went, no. I said, I'm not afraid, I am afraid. And he went, here, try this. So I tried that. I wasn't afraid anymore. I said, Punch, I did that perfect alcoholic thing. I said, Punch, can we get more of this? And he said, yeah. And I said, where'd you get it? He said, them guys that are shooting at us sold it to me this afternoon. My first encounter with chemical warfare. I said, I'll be back. I laid my gun down, took my 782 gear off, low crawled over in the middle of no man's land and called Achmat. Got his name from Punch. He goes, what? I says, business. He says, be right with you, Johnny. So he crawled out and sold me some hashish in the middle of the firefight, and I went back to the foxhole, and I was never without hashish or booze again in my life. I did not function well without something. I made good friends with the corpsman. I loved those little white crosses and anything else that the corpsman would give me to go somewhere. He used to give me these big speed pills. We called them Guam turnarounds. You can take two of those, drive to Guam, turn around, and drive back before you need to go to sleep. And you could drink the whole way, too, you know. I always use drugs either to get more drinking or to get over drinking. Or when I couldn't drink, I would use drugs. Drinking was my leitmotif. The others were just supporting parts. I got out of the Marine Corps, went back to the same college, and got kicked out again. This time we made the newspapers, Grove City College students graduate magna cum laude. Yeah, there we go. And I don't know about you, but back in the late 50s, early 60s, we got married under different circumstances. A proposal usually went like this. You're what? You know how they say like, unlikes attract? Well, that's true. She was pregnant, I wasn't. So we were attracted to each other and we got married. What a mistake that was, you know. And she later escaped. I now tell people that I believe in women's liberation. I've set two free. Go. Go and I won't sin anymore. Did you notice what a great day this is? Yesterday and the day before that, I was up in this area doing some work for my company, and it was so hot that I couldn't stand it. And I was inside an air-conditioned building. It was still hot. So this is beautiful. Thanks for asking me here today. I appreciated the drive up this morning. It was beautiful. But so I got married and had this beginning of a career. And looking good. I look good. I don't know if the rest of you alcoholics can identify with this, but I looked good. I tested well. I looked good. I said the right things. People were look at me and say, God, he's got potential, promise. This is a comer. And I would come up lame in the stretch. I just couldn't quite finish something. Let's just put it real bluntly. I was a total failure at everything. I failed at school. I failed in the Marine Corps. I was in the Marine Corps when they were gearing up for Vietnam. I'd been there when it was called French Indochina, and I had an MOS that was, besides being a lifeguard swim instructor, I was a code authenticator, and they needed people like me. And when it came time for me to get out, no one asked me to stay. That's what the Marine Corps thought of me, you know. And just get him out of here. He's not worth it. And they were right. And I failed at Marine Corps. I failed at marriage. I failed at every career I started. And I always looked good going in. I took the test. I would ace their Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory and all those other tests. And I had I even aced the Mensa test and had a Mensa card, you know, and oh boy, I was insufferable. I was the one in the bar that always thought he was Einstein and everybody else was just garbage collectors, you know. I'd tell people, I'd explain people how the things worked and the whole business. Bless you. Didn't get any on you, did you?
No.
But I was a failure. And I just sort of was a traveling failure, too. I was a move-along drunk. I wasn't bad enough to put in jail, but I wasn't enough, good enough to keep most everywhere I went. And they would just say, move along. Just move along. I went to California and back twice, just moving along. I ended up, toward the end, I was a hippie. I really wasn't a hippie. I just looked like one. I quit bathing, quit shaving, wore funny clothes, had one of them peace signs hanging around my neck. I'm going to tell you something. I'm not dumb. I figured it out right away. The morals in the hippie community, all those leftists, those socialists, the morals were very low over there. You could get laid easier over there than you could over here with the John Birchers. And even though I was a John Bircher, I was hanging out with these people over here because I'm young and I understand the meaning of importance and priority. And I always told people that the reality check was in the mail, wait for it. And I just sort of floated around for a couple years after the wife left, and I didn't work too much. I worked a little bit, and then they would say, John, we don't need you anymore. Why don't you try such and such? And as I said, I went to California and back twice, just moving along. And I ended up in dreary Erie, the mistake on the lake, Pennsylvania. Late April 1968, and I had been confronted with the reality of myself. I'm killing things up here. There we go. Spire in. And I thought I would quit drinking. I'd already quit drugging. I didn't have enough money to buy drugs anymore. So I quit drinking. And I made it 3 days without drinking. That's the longest I'd ever gone without drinking. 3 days. And then suddenly, I thought to myself, I can't live drinking, and this is sure no way to live without drugs and alcohol, so the hell with it. I'm going to commit suicide. And I had an alcoholic car. I'm sure that everybody in here knows what one looks like. They're unique. You see them around AA clubhouses and places down on the lower companion side of town, you know. And I had one of those, and I figured, well, it's time to just give it up. So I was going to go out on the interstate and run my car into a bridge abutment. And I had my car up to about 85 miles an hour heading for that bridge abutment. And I ran out of gas. Oh, kid, it's funny now. You should have seen it that morning. I'm thinking to myself, my God, you can't even pull a suicide off, let alone, have a successful life. And some fool came by and gave me a gallon of gas. And I thought to myself, you know, if I try this again, I'll probably end up with a flat tire or something and make my hands dirty, and I don't want to do that. So I said, I think I'll go back to town and think about this. That was a euphemism to say, I'm going to go and find a bar and drink. Tell the bartender my troubles. And I went back to town, went to a bar, and it wasn't open, and I stood there. I wasn't well enough to think to go next door either way or across the street, go to a bar or anywhere else. Just couldn't put it together. And I ended up standing there crying because I couldn't drink, couldn't live without drinking, and here I am, I can't even commit suicide. So I called AA because several people had mentioned it to me over the years. I don't know why, but they had mentioned it to me and left. I had a wife that left little pamphlets everywhere I'd be, you know. And or those, you know, those inserts in the Sunday paper, are you an alcoholic? And it gives the questions, you know. I took one of those tests one time and it had 44 questions on it. I answered 42 of them yes. The two I didn't answer yes to was, do you keep a bottle in your desk at work? And I said, no, it's in the file cabinet. And the 44th question was, does your drinking increase during your menstrual cycle? And of course I wrote no, but then I thought back, it did when she had one, so I aced that test. And other people had mentioned AA to me, you know, in passing. Why'd you go to AA, you bum? And just all kinds of stuff like that. So I went to AA, called AA, called them up on the phone. Thank God they had answering service. Guy says, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Can I help you? And I said, yeah, I think I might be an alcoholic. He says, where are you? I told him a lie. Told him I was on the complete opposite end of town from where I was. He says, we got a couple guys that live out that way. They'll come over and see you. I said, no. Tell me where you are, come see you. He told me where they were, and I thought to myself, God, that's where them bums hang out. Well, I'd be right at home, but I wasn't thinking that way. And I said, I'll come down there. And I drove down there, and it was a mess. I jumped the curb, knocked over a parking meter, fell out of the door, pulled myself up with the coat hanger that was using for a radio antenna. And I didn't walk across the street. I just leaned forward and vibrated over there, you know. Been a couple days without a drink. And they took me in. First thing they said to me is, would you like a cup of coffee? I don't drink coffee. Never have. Don't like it. Never will. Like the smell of it. God, it's just a beautiful smell, but I don't like it. But, you know, just to be nice and not mess up their rhythm, I said, yeah, I'll take a cup of coffee. Now, styrofoam had not been invented yet. So they gave me a big old China mug with a jug ear on it, you know. And I held that for about 3 seconds, and I was a little nervous. I spilled it on the ceiling. And so they said, we'll bring you coffee from now on. Don't worry about it. Don't. And they bring me about that much coffee in the bottom of one of those mugs, and I'd two-handed up and sound like castanets on, on the teeth, what teeth I had left at that time. Miracle. Guy said to me the other day, he says, "Are those your teeth?" I says, "Yes, I paid for them." You got yours free. I paid for mine. Anyhow, these old guys, it looked like God's waiting room. Just a bunch of old burnout fools, 55, 60, 65 years old. It looked like, as I said, God's waiting room. They were just waiting for God to say, "Next, come on up." And then they die and go on up. And I thought to myself, "My God, I'm 30 years old. And I look like a hippie." I was the first hippie they'd ever seen up close, too. I had red hair down to the shoulders. Had a leather headband on there. The headband was important because I'm bald, and I take that hair and bring it up over and put that headband on there. A headband had a pronoun and an active verb on it, and I looked good. I had these peace signs hanging on me and everything like that, but I didn't want anybody to think I was a wimp, so I had my Marine Corps medals here too, you know, let them know that you know, I'm not one of them. I'm just hanging out with them for the sex. And found out that the Berkshires didn't do much drugging either. I didn't appreciate that. Anyhow, these old guys, I had a story made up to tell them, and none of them asked me for my story. None of them. They were so anxious to tell me their story, and now I figured that out after a while. These guys sitting around all the time waiting for somebody that's new so they can jump in and tell their story again. And so these guys were telling their story, and I'm thinking to myself, "I never did that." Or I was thinking, "Is that all you've done?" You know, "Is that all you've done? You're not that bad." But at the end of the day, one old timer looked at me and he said, "I've got to go home." Obviously, he needed to take a nap, you know, at that age. I understand that now. I didn't understand it when I was 30, but now I'm 64. That napping's good. And he said, "Do you think you're an alcoholic, judging from what you heard here today?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I'm an alcoholic." He said, "Do you want to do something about it?" "I'm here." "Yes. Yes, I want to do something about it." "Do you believe in God?" "Well, I went to that Christian college, and I knew there was God. I hung out with a bunch of people that believed in Him, and I just didn't have a personal God at that time, so I knew what he wanted to hear, so I said, 'Yeah, I believe in God.'" And he got this big smile on his face, and he goes, "Oh," he says, "that's wonderful. Those are the first three steps. We'll start on your inventory tomorrow morning." I hadn't seen a big book yet. I had not been in a room where they had the steps hanging on the wall. I didn't know what he was talking about. But I thought, well, three down. How many to go? I don't know. But I went home. I was going to go home, and another guy came in, and he says, "What are you doing between now and time to go to the meeting tonight?" Well, my social calendar wasn't real full at that time, so I said, "I really don't have any plans." He says, "Well, let's get out of the yacht club, take my boat out." I had not been invited to the yacht club very often either lately. And so I said, "Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I'll go with you." And we went outside, and he said, "Is that your car?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "We'll take mine." And they wouldn't have allowed mine in the yacht club. I finally figured that out. And went to the yacht club. And about six other AA people came. And they believed in those days that what you needed to do when you were brand new and just off booze and suffering from malnutrition and vitamin deficiencies and had a craving for sugar and everything like that, that the thing to do was mix honey and orange juice together and have the new guy drink it. Well, that wouldn't have been bad. But the person that went to a store where they didn't have any honey and they didn't have any orange juice. So she came to the boat with a bottle of Cairo syrup and a can of apricot nectar. It was like drinking a sweet rug. You know? And it didn't stay down very well. And I went over and fed the fish a couple times. And I came back and I said, "This isn't working." And they said, no, "That Cairo syrup is sticky. Some of it's staying. Just keep drinking." You know? And We went back down to the A&A office and got my car after we came in and went to my first meeting. And a man had introduced himself to me. I am your sponsor. Okay. And he met me, and we were going in the church, and the meeting was in the basement of the church, and there were double swinging doors at the top of the stairs and at the bottom of the stairs. I pointed this out earlier. I'm badly crippled. I just happened to limp in both legs, and I lost it on about the second step going down, and just sort of tumbled. I'd learned how to fall, and I tumbled and went through the double doors and flat out on the floor, and the chairman said, "Oh, here's the new guy." And I always wondered, how did they know I was the new guy? And something happened that night that doesn't happen in AA anymore, and I have mixed feelings about it. But at the beginning of the meeting, my sponsor elbowed me in the ribs and said, "Come on." And we went up to the podium, and we knelt on the floor beside the podium, and he prayed, and I read the third step prayer in unison, because they wanted me to be real sure that I wanted to be one of them. They qualified me the whole day. Somebody would ask, "Are you ready to quit drinking for the rest of your life? Are you really sure about this? And we don't want you smoking any of them left-handed cigarettes either, you know?" And all kinds of stuff like that. They qualified me all the time. And after the first meeting, it was over, the newcomers got to go to the kitchen and wash dishes. And we had a little dessert that night, so we had a dessert plate, a saucer, a cup, a fork, and a spoon. And they looked at how shaky I was, and they told me that I would go over here and just wash the spoons, because they weren't sharp and wouldn't break. And I got into service the first night I was in AA. I struck, you know. And a couple weeks later, by God, they brought some other new person in, told him to wash spoons, and damn near pissed me off, because I thought, hey, that's my job. And they said, "No, you can go over and do forks now, John." I told them what they could do with their forks, you know. But I did it. And we swept floors. We emptied ashtrays for all you smokers. I was a smoker there. Why not? Everybody smoked. We had a book in AA at that time. It was entitled Caffeine, Nicotine, and God. And it just seemed like everybody just smoked cigarettes, drank coffee, and talked about God. I even started drinking coffee. I hated it. They would joke about me and coffee. I'd put so much cream and sugar in there. One guy said, you make a pretty good coffee pudding there, you know. And one day my sponsor said to me, he says, "You don't like coffee, do you?" And I said, "No." And he says, "Don't drink it." Boy, I'm on the road to Damascus. My first epiphany in AA. I don't have to drink coffee. God, what a thrill that was. And I could drink water. And I just was wonderful. And it was like, and true to their word, the next day in AA, I went down and had breakfast with these bold burnout fools, and they started on my inventory. One of them said, "What's the worst thing you ever did?" Well, just stop and think a minute. A couple things I couldn't talk about because they were still under the statute of limitations. And a couple of them weren't things I wanted to brag about anyhow. And it took me a few rejections of thoughts. Finally, I came up with something I could tell them that wouldn't be too bad. And I matched them every now and then, story for story. And we just talked to each other that day. I didn't realize I was doing a combination fourth and fifth step. It was successful and it was unsuccessful. It was successful in that it blunted the edge of the desire to drink. I told enough to pull enough guilt out to get over the desire to drink immediately. I didn't tell enough to get rid of what I think of today as cancer of the soul. I still had cancer in my soul, and it was growing. And I lied from that point on about the steps. I did steps, and I lied about doing steps. And I lied about the things that I was doing in AA. And my sponsor, I wasn't what you would call one of the great AA members. Come July of 1969, I started seeing posters and heard talk about something that was going to happen just north of where I was. And I thought to myself, by God, I want to go. And it was advertised as Woodstock, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I thought to myself, two out of three ain't bad, I'm going. And I went to Woodstock in August of 1969. I was 15 months sober, stayed sober, stayed upwind of all them brown clouds, took advantage of all the people that were under the influence, especially the women. I mean, make sure you understand that. But I'm a pervert, but it's because I like women. And I came back from Woodstock, and my sponsor said, where have you been? And I told him I went to Woodstock. And he said, is that the stuff I've been seeing on television? I said, yeah. He says, good. Hold that thought. You'll be sure to talk about it to your new sponsor. So I got fired. And a few weeks later, my new sponsor took me out to a different place for coffee after the meeting one night and said, threw a $20 bill on the counter between us and said, why don't you go on a real drunk, and when you're ready, come back. I was dumb. I didn't even take the $20, but I packed and moved that night. Moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and got a new sponsor down there. And about 4 days later, he said to me, he said, how long did you say you've been sober? And I told him, and he said, don't act that way. Maybe we ought to start working the steps. I moved to West Virginia that afternoon, and I became the business manager of a therapeutic community for alcoholics and drug addicts. And due to a series of serious mistakes and just bad luck on the part of the company that I worked for, people got drunk, people left, and I ended up being the director of this treatment center. Wasn't even 2 years sober, and I was the director. And I was on KDKA television and radio one night as an expert on alcoholism and drug addiction. And my sponsor caught me after the broadcast, and he said, you really are an expert. He said, let's break that word down. X refers to an unknown, and a spurt is a drip under pressure. You're it. And I fired him that night. I went to work one day, and I got a phone call from a very attractive woman who worked at the vocational rehab. And she said, why don't you come up and have lunch with me today? And I thought to myself, I have been hitting on this woman ever since I got to town. We're going to have a nooner. We met at the restaurant. Seven other people showed up. A couple AA friends, a doctor, and another BVR person, and a couple people from the board of directors. And the end result of the lunch was they took my car away from me, my company car. They fired me. They evicted me from my home. They packed my bags, and they offered me a ticket to a treatment center. And if I wanted to go, fine. If not, just pick up your bags and keep going. I'm not dumb. I didn't have anywhere to go. This treatment center would be at least a month, and I could, you know, figure out something to do while I was there. So I went to treatment. And I think I mentioned that I had lied a little bit and half-stepped through this program. I talked a good program. I listened a good program, but I didn't live one. And I got to treatment, and it was sort of difficult. I was neither fish nor fowl. I wasn't really identifying with the patients because I'd been sober almost 2 years, and I wasn't identifying with the staff because I'm no longer a professional, and it was just sort of difficult. And they attacked me one day, and in my exhaustion, I started to blurt out the truth. I finally took a complete fourth step, and in the process gave a complete fifth step. I told everything. I told things I shouldn't have told. I told things that were just low, mean, slimy stuff. And I realized what I'd done. It took me about 2 hours and 40 minutes to pour it all out. And I realized what I had done, and I quickly got up and started to leave the room, but I had told them all, 80 of them in the room, I told them what to do, where to do it, and to make sure that the sun never shone on it again. And what happened was I never made it to the door, because my fellow patients actually lifted me off the floor and held me in the air so I couldn't leave. And they told me that they loved me. And it was a little old lady from Charlotte, North Carolina, and she whispered in my ear, she said, "John, you have become the Velveteen Rabbit today. You're real. You're one of us." And a few days later, I got a phone call from Mental Health, Mental Retardation Director of the State of Ohio, and he offered me a job, and I said, "My God, do you know where I am?" He says, "I called you, John." He says, "I know you're in treatment. We also know that you did a very, very good job, even when you were in the sickest you've ever been, when you ran that therapeutic community in Pennsylvania and West Virginia. We'd like to have you come work for us." And I did, and I started working full-time in the field of alcoholism and drug addiction. That lasted for a couple years. I burned out, went back to my chosen profession, which is I am a chef, and I worked as a chef, and I've been on board of directors of treatment centers and everything like that. I've worked in several hospitals. When I moved to Atlanta, I didn't have any. I took one chefing job for 3 days, and went to work for Fulton County Health Department, and then went to work for the Charter Medical Corporation Group and Ridgeview. But when I was there, I called it Ridgeview because they didn't always agree with my ideas. We had philosophical differences. I was right. I left them and went with the Georgia State Board of Pardon and Parole. I became the one thing in my life that I hated more than anything else. I became a law enforcement person. I hated them. I hate cops. I really don't like them even to this day. Some of my best friends are cops. But I think God in His infinite wisdom realized how much I hate law enforcement people, and so I sponsor several policemen, a couple state policemen, one FBI agent, and a couple private detectives. And, you know, God has a sense of humor, and he just poking me all the time. But I got fired from there because they privatized my section. No one bought it, and they let me go. And I came back into the private industry, and I'm just so glad to be in private industry now. I'm on the other side of the fence now. I'm a drug alcohol tester. I told that to somebody one time, and they said, "Boy, how do you get a job like that?" And I said, no, you don't understand. I get people to pee in cups and then send it off for testing. They go, oh, my. I was a drug alcohol tester, by God, when I was out there on the streets. Hey, this is pretty good. Try one of these. It'll spin you around sideways. When I got to the sixth and seventh steps, my first sponsor carried me from Erie, Pennsylvania to Cleveland, Ohio. And the object was we were going over to hear this man speak. His name was Alan Gallagher. He was from Eatontown, New Jersey. He had this beautiful AA talk. My sponsor wanted me to hear him because at the end of his talk, Mr. Gallagher always said, "I submit to you that it is easier to act yourself into proper thinking than it is to think yourself into proper acting." My sponsor always tried to break his elbow on my ribs. Did you get that? Oh, yes, I did. We're driving home. It's 105 miles back to Erie. We don't take the interstate. We take the scenic route at midnight, you know. And we're talking about this acting yourself into proper thinking rather than think yourself into proper acting. And this is going on for miles. And finally I said, Bill, I've done that all my life. Oh, the brakes went on. We went off the road. Handbrake was set. Finger went up in the air. And I don't know if you've been in AA long enough to realize that when the sponsor finger goes up in the air, you are in trouble. Because it came down and said, no, you haven't. You've been pretending to be something in order to fool people. We want you to act like something in order to become it. And he says, we're going to start with the four absolutes right away. We want you to act with absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity, and absolute love. We want you to act that way. We know you can't live there, but we want you to start acting that way. And he says, incidentally, I want you to talk to such and such about honesty. And I said, he's an ex-con. He spent half his life in prison. What do I get? He says, he had 17 years to think about honesty. He's got it down pretty good. So I went to see this ex-con, you know. And all right, Bill sent me over to talk to you about honesty. And he said, it's about time. I resembled that. And he said, it's three things, John. If it's not yours, don't pick it up. If it's not true, don't say it. And if it's not right, don't do it. And of course, immediately I said, yes, but. He says, no, John, no yes buts on this one. This is concrete, no abstracts. This is it. You do those three, that's it. Well, that was 30-some years ago, and I still haven't found the exception to it. So maybe you're not taking notes, but try to remember this. If it's not yours, don't pick it up. If it's not true, don't say it. If it's not right, don't do it. Okay. He later told me what to do about service. If it's empty, fill it up. If it's full, empty it. If it needs to be done, do it. That's service. Eighth and ninth step, God, they were easy. Some people didn't even wait till I got to the eighth step. They wanted their money right now. But, you know, most ninth steps were easy. You just paid the money back. No, and never say you're sorry. Just say, I made a mistake. I was wrong. Here. Oh, I paid one guy back, had owed him for 12 years. You know what he said? Your credit's good with me. And I said, my God, I just paid you back for, I had this money for 12 years. He says, good. He says, I got a drawer full of people here that never paid back. He said, you're aces with me. He says, if I can get the rest of these people in AA, I'd be happy. But then it came time to make amends that didn't have monetary value on them. And I had to go to people like my ex-wife and say, I was wrong. I treated you badly. I made mistakes. What can I do to make it right? She is not a shrinking violet, the doctor. She said, could you die? And then immediately she said, don't do that. I don't want it on my conscience. But how about just sticking with the court order and never, never see me or my family or anybody that were connected with me ever again? So I cried. He says, she sounds like a smart woman. He said, I wouldn't want you around either. I won't be a father. She's taken away my God-given right to be a father. And he said, oh, shut up. And he says, let's get down the street. There's a place down here called Big Brothers. We'll get you signed up, and you can be a father to how many ever kids you want. Okay. So I'm down there, and I'm playing dad to these kids that absolutely, positively need a dad. And I'm having fun. And then I'm at a meeting one time, and there's a woman there with a little child, and the child's acting up, and you know the woman's got to get up and leave and take the kid with her, and she's new in the program, and the sponsor says to me, go get the kid, take it outside and play. I said, yes, but he's no. So I became a sort of a para babysitter at AA. I started carrying toys with me. Because as soon as some kid started acting up, I'd go pick the kid up and go outside and play. I had a lot of fun doing that. I worked out a lot of my father image stuff by helping, by being nice to kids, by seeking it out and doing the right thing. And I got married the second time, and I played with those kids like they were real. I play with kids as if they're just little adults. I don't talk down to them. I don't patronize them. They're just little adults to me. Well, that worked. That worked real well. And I got into the ninth step, making amends, and there were a lot of people I had to go and tell them I was dumb. You know, when you go to a wedding, and there's somewhere where the minister says, "Is there anyone here that knows any reason why this couple shouldn't be joined in holy matrimony?" And nobody ever says anything, you know? Not that day. My cousin's wedding. I had just enough in me to fill up the holes that would have kept me from doing anything. And so I got up and explained why she shouldn't marry the dumb SOB. And I was never invited to another family wedding again. And it wasn't too long after that, my favorite uncle died, and I went to his funeral, and I had just enough to be a little bit woozy, and I got down near the grave, and I'm badly crippled, as I said, so I stepped on a clod of dirt, and it sort of threw me, and I body blocked three of my relatives and myself into the hole. Never got invited to another funeral. Got thrown out of that one. And when you have to go make amends for those are tough. But you know what my cousin said to me? She says, "I've already divorced the SOB, and he was dumb. You were right, but God, there would have been some other way for you to tell me, you know." And now I get invited to funerals and weddings all the time. 11th step, 10th step. 10th step is like so simple. Continue. What are you going to continue? The 4th and 5th step. If you do the 4th and 5th step and the 10th step so many times, but with the same person or the same situation, obviously you have a 6th step character defect and you have a shortcoming because you're acting on it. It's time to do something about it. I love that this program just circles. Just keeps circling. You clean up your act, you get better. You don't stay the same. You either get better, you get worse, and you get worse, you're going out. Or you're becoming miserable. 11th step, prayer and meditation. Prayer is when I talk to God. Meditation is when I listen. God does not come down with burning bushes or rents in the cloud and the big voice saying, "John, I want you to do this." Nothing. I don't get that. Maybe I live the wrong kind of life, or I'm not listening at the right time, or in the right bush area. But what I found is when I'm talking to God in my prayer, it's a good idea for me to tell my sponsor, my spiritual advisor, and my home group what I'm praying about. And then shut up and listen, because my God talks to me through you. You're my lesson. You share your experience. You know, you might have had the exact same thing happen, and you can help me through it. I like that part of the program. Get into the 12th step where it says, had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And notice it only comes after you've done the 11. As the result of these steps. And you have that spiritual awakening. You know God's in you and with you and around you and been leading you. Carry the message. Second part of the 12th step to me. That's what I'm doing now. But I also do it by going to the jail, by talking to people, by sharing my experience at a one-to-one or writing a note in the message, or being there to explain the history of AA in an archives display, being part of this, being part of the service the unity and the recovery of our triangle. And then that last part of the 12th step, the hardest part of this whole program, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Practice. Practice. Make them part of your life. Make them just what you do. I embarrassed myself here a couple months ago. I was asked to speak at the Chamber of Commerce dual meeting down where I live, and they've introduced me, and I walked up and I said, "Hi, my name's John Cornelius, I'm an alcoholic." Damn. There's several in the crowd looking at me, and I said, "Well, bad habit, but that's what I am. Now let's go from there." I had that happen, it didn't happen to me, but I used to do a aftercare group at the Atlanta airport, and I had pilots and baggage handlers and ticket agents and flight attendants and everything in my aftercare group. Sometimes there'd be 200 people in the aftercare group in the period of an afternoon. This four-stripe captain walked in one time. Everybody started laughing. I said, "What's wrong?" And everybody started talking. He said, "No, let me tell you." And it seems that the Thursday before, he had the 7:30 red-eye flight to Washington, D.C., and he was out at the end of the runway in line and got on the microphone, said, "Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Captain John Smith, and I'm an alcoholic." I said, "What'd you do?" He said, "I shut the microphone off, told everybody in the cockpit to shut up, and looked in the little rearview mirrors, made sure nobody was jumping out." And he said, "I came back on and said, but I've been sober 17 months and we're going to Washington." But the good part is that during the course of the flight, 8 people sent notes forward that they were friends of Bill W. and God love them. We're never alone. Even when we think we're the most alone, we're never alone. There's somebody there. I'm about ready to start winding up here, but I have to tell you something. Remember when my first sponsor back in 1968 made me go here, Alan Gallagher from Eatontown, New Jersey. And Alan Gallagher said, in effect, "It's easier to act yourself into proper thinking than it is to think yourself into proper acting." And over the course of the years, I have used and quoted Alan Gallagher from Eatontown, New Jersey, constantly. I've wove one of my lectures around Alan Gallagher from Eatontown, New Jersey, and everything like that. I'm a Santa Claus. I'm a professional Santa Claus. I'm very, very good at it. And my company called me 6 years ago and said, "John, where would you like to go to be Santa Claus this year?" And I said, more to the point, "I'd like to go where they pay such and such money." And she said, "There's only 6 places in the United States that pay that kind of money." She said, "Denver, Houston, Chicago, Cleveland." And she said, "I've got a great big mall in New Jersey in this little town there." I said, "Where is that?" And she said, "Eatontown, New Jersey." And I said, "God, that's where I want to go." 28 years. 28 years from when I had heard him and that come up, that thread. So I said, "Yeah, send me to Eatontown." She said, "I'll try to get it for you." They got it. They meant my money. I showed up about 4 days early, went around and found my AA meeting, the one I could get to at 7:30 in the morning, still make it to work, the one I could go to 11 o'clock at night after I get off the Santa Claus chair. Because I tell you this, if you're an alcoholic and you're Santa Claus, you better get some meetings in. Not the kids, the parents will drive you crazy. Especially up there around New York City. God. I love the kids, but gee, what happens to people up there? They get rude and crude. Anyhow, I'm up there, and it's the first Sunday that I'm on the Santa Claus chair. I only have to work till 6 o'clock. I'm leading the old-timers meeting for Metropolitan New York that night. Woman came and sat on my lap, and I said, "What's your name?" And she said, "You know what my name is, Daddy. This is my daughter. This is the one the court said never to see again. This is the one that my wife kept away from me. This is the one that when they came to my mother's funeral, I had to leave town while they were there. This was my daughter." And we had a very tearful, God smiled on us that day. And she told me, she said, "In all honesty," she said, "this is wonderful." She said, "but I really came just to see what a son of a bitch looked like." And she said, "You're not, are you?" And I said, "I hope I'm not, because my sponsor told me that one day you would come to find me and that I should be doing something good and I should be sober when it happened. And I can't think of a better thing to do than to be a sober Santa Claus, helping kids have a good time." And we have a relationship now. It's not really father-daughter. It's more like we're friends. But we're good friends. And she's introduced her stepchildren to me as, "This is your other Santa Claus, or this is your other grandfather." Last time we had lunch, and she said, "Do you have anything besides red suits?" I said, "No, not really. I wear a lot of red." I had to believe that what I had to do was act like a father in order to be one, so that when my daughter came, I knew what to do to be a father. Something I'd never known how to do when she was with me. And it was one of the great moments of AA for me. In fact, that night when I'm doing my prayers, I said, "God, if you need somebody in a hurry, I can go now. This has been wonderful. It's been a great trip." And obviously that didn't happen. A few years later, a friend of mine, he's our alternate delegate in AA, said to me, "Are you working right now?" And I said, "No, I'm between jobs." And he said, "I need some help. I'm making a movie. How would you like to be a production assistant?" And I said, "Fine. What's the movie?" He said, "The movie is going to be entitled House Full of Miracles. It's going to be about AA. It's going to be filmed in Dr. Bob's house. You're going to be one of my production assistants." I want you to understand, production assistant might sound good, but what it means is, go get a cup of coffee, go pick that up, do this, do that. I was a gopher. And my ego doesn't go for gopher. So I said, "Do you mind if I bring my cameras with me and make a photo history of making this film?" And so I became the still photographer and the historian, the photo historian of making that film. And I was working in post-production with it. And the film required a narrator. And we had a big-time movie star who's in AA and had about 26 years of sobriety, and he was filming a very famous film, but he was over in Italy and he couldn't get back to narrate the film. And Dick was in a little bit of a hurry, so he handed me the script, 17 pages, and he said, "Here, read this on the way to the sound studio. You're it." And then he talked to me all the way to the sound studio, so I never got to read it. And I walked into the sound studio and the engineer was ready to go. I didn't get to read it again, and I walked in, and I don't know if you've ever been to a sound studio, but it's a scary place because it's totally silent, can't hear anything. I could hear the blood in my veins. It was so quiet. And I read this 17 pages of typescript, and I cried at the end when I came to the point where Dr. Bob's last words to Bill were, "Keep it simple. Don't mess this up." And that's my watchwords. And I was crying in that sound booth. And when I was finished and they cut it off, I said, "If you'll let me compose myself, I'll do it again and do it right. And the sound engineer and Dick both said together, no, it stands. We want the emotion in there. So if you ever get a chance to see that movie, House Full of Miracles, that's me. And I thought after my daughter that there couldn't be anything else that would be exciting in this program. I just laugh at myself because every day I'm in this program, something better happens. I became the archivist for the state of Georgia. I love history. History is a major part of my life. And now I get to carry that torch of our history and carry it and keep it bright and pass it on at some time so that we will never lose sight of who we are, what we are, and where we came from. Where we won't mess this thing up. We will keep it simple. And that's my job right now, is to always remind you that our program worked 67 years ago Monday, and it has worked every day since. And it has worked in the most horrendous circumstances, and it has stayed effective as long as we effectively do nothing to change it. We don't want to make it different. This happens to be a first edition copy of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the sad things about this book is that every story in this book, in the back of this book, even the Al-Anon story, how many of you knew there was an Al-Anon story in the big book back in the first edition? Even that one, every one of them, the last paragraph or two ends with praise, gratitude, and adoration for God. Pick up the new fourth edition. Count the stories that don't praise God, don't have an attitude of gratitude to God, don't glory in the fact that God gave us this program. It will break your heart. Just barely half of the stories give credit where credit's due. This is the part of the program that we're trying to keep. Enough of me on my soapbox. A lot of people ask me after 12,000 and some AA meetings why I still come. And I tell them, obviously you haven't read the big book. I have. And by God, I'm glad those first bunch of guys that I ran into had read the big book, because they 12-stepped me the way the big book says to 12-step me. They recounted their stories and the horror of their past, not to wallow in it, but to help me identify. In your big book, if you have a third or fourth edition, it's on page 89. In this first edition, it's on page 101, second paragraph. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been a bright spot in my life today. God love you. I do. Thank you.